input.
Do we think you signed up? Quite a few people. Great.
Okay, we always start off with a reminder about the commission rules, because we do try to stick with them, especially when we have lots of people who've signed up. The commission offers 3 minutes to citizens. I'd like you to come forward, sit in a chair just in front of a microphone. You don't need to get too close to the mic, but once your 3 minutes have elapsed, you will hear a beeping noise. Sometimes people can't hear as they're so focused on what they're saying, and in that case, I will politely interrupt you and let you know your time is up. And we would like you to conclude your remarks. I'll call you up two at a time. Dan Patilla and Bruce Vandervoort, if you'd come forward. Okay, Mr. Pentella?
Yes. Test, test. May I proceed?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Dan Pentella, 5108 Kingsway, Anacortes, Washington. This pertains to the proposed smelt rule change options. I was employed by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife from December 1971 through June 2010. Almost entirely involved in Puget Sound forage fish units and projects specializing in surf smelt matters. Much of the current WDFW forage fish spawning habitat survey database is based on decades and tens of thousands of samples collected during my field work. Since retirement, I have operated a forage fish-related marine biological consulting business. In full disclosure, I have been requested to attend this commission by a commercial surf smelt fisherman. The following comments are in addition to my written comments submitted online pertinent to this matter on about April 11th, 2014. As per policy on testimony, I will not detail them further other than to state that they dealt with the large de facto reserve of unfished surf smelt spawning habitat occurring in Puget Sound, inherent limitations to local smelt fisheries independent of fish abundance, and the need for steadfast adherence to strict limitations on to armoring of surf smelt spawning habitats. I presume the panel has reviewed these comments. Two additional items that were beyond the 1,000-character written comment limitation. The applicability of Camino Island surf smelt spawn data. The Northern Camino Island surf smelt fishing area, study area, supports much of the commercial smelt catch in the entire Puget Sound Basin these days. Catch rates there cannot be construed to occur all over the rest of the 250 miles of known surf smelt spawning habitat in Puget Sound so as to create an impression of a monstrous fishery, nor can perceptions of declines of Camino Island smelt abundance. Smelt are a short-lived species, and fluctuations in abundance can be expected in the short term. Presumably, WDFW will provide a summary of where else in the Puget Sound Basin surf smelt sport and commercial fisheries were monitored in order to come up with an impression that this species is over-harvested, thus resulting in the current proposal. The second item, what problem is greater, fishery harvests or continued habitat degradation? The current WDFW approach resembles the recent worldwide forage fish policy declarations of the Pew Trust and the Lenfest International Forage Fish Task Force, whose aim is to control both existing and potential forage fish harvests through management policy manipulation. Unfortunately, a glaring omission in the Pew Lenfest juggernaut is that any interest already?
Yes. Okay.
Anyway, the Pew Lenfest ignore habitat management issues in their attempts to manage forage fish worldwide, and I would still support option one, no change in this matter.
Thank you, Bruce Barnes. Would you come forward? Okay, Mr.
Can I leave the microphone
Yes, yes. Okay, Mr. Vandervoort.
My name is Bruce Vandervoort. I'm president of the Washington State Trappers Association. Speaking for the Trappers Association, I have two proposals I would like you to consider. The first is to allow CITES tagging of bobcat and otter pelts by designated non-department personnel, such as fur dealers and Trappers Association representatives, in addition to fish and wildlife personnel. For those that don't know, all bobcats and otters must be tagged as the state of origin under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species as look-alike species to cross international boundaries. Tagging of these animals is merely a matter of record keeping, and we feel non-department personnel could easily take this over. The advantage to trappers would be the convenience of being able to have their pelts tagged at the point of sale or shipment. Currently, we can only get pelts tagged at regional offices during business hours, which can be a hardship. The advantage to the department is a savings to the department. We have been told in the past by department personnel that it costs near $200,000 a year in department manpower to CITES tag bobcats and otters. The second proposal is to eliminate otter season bag limits and closed areas for otter in eastern Washington. This is left over from a time when otter were scarce in eastern Washington. They have not been for some time. We can now only use cage traps for fur trapping, which has cut into trappers' effectiveness to take otter. We feel our ability to over-harvest the otter population is non-existent. We have a situation now where otter may be legally taken on one side of the Columbia, but not on the other side. Otter do get caught as incidental catch in beaver traps. We would prefer not to waste them. I keep hearing anecdotal reports of otter being killed in the closed areas and either discarded or reported in another county. We feel that the department is not getting an accurate picture of the otter population because of this misreporting. I also am hearing about otter killed as nuisance wildlife where they are causing damage in the closed areas. We feel that otter seasons should be standardized statewide and season bag limits eliminated. We have been talking to the department about these issues for 6+ years, and every year we seem to get agreement that these are good ideas, but nothing seems to happen. Trapping regulations are no longer printed, but only available online, and we see no reason why these changes couldn't be adopted at any time instead of only in 3-year packages when they come out. That's all.
Thank you. Couple of questions here. Commissioner Schmitten first.
Thank you, Chair. And wanted to let the speaker know that today the Wildlife Committee met per the suggestions of George Brady. And the issues that we went over today concerning trapping were ability of fur dealers to tag animals similar to other states. Your point one, use of humane traps in addition to what's currently required, cost of fur dealer licenses, and trapping education classes. And I would like to thank Mr. Brady and yourself for coming. I think we made some progress. It would take a whack change, and I think you'll find that on some of these issues that there's agreement that we'd like to pursue.
Commissioner Smith.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that, do you know how many other states allow tagging, or roughly, is it a common practice on CITES?
Allow tagging all bobcats and otters caught in the United States have to be CITES tagged. It's a federal program.
Right. I meant by trappers. By
trappers. Yeah. I don't know how many, but I do know that some do. I know some southern states actually just mail out the CITES tags to trappers to put on the pelts. It's really, you know, I agree the information needs to be, you know, gathered on this stuff, but it's when you go to get your pelts tagged, all they do is take down that information and put the tag on the animal, and you're out the door. So, and we don't just feel that anybody should do that because, but, you know, the department should be able to designate people that they trust to take that information and turn it into them. So.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I imagine that's something that you'll look at in terms of is it an accepted practice and that. But good. Right. Thanks for your
response. Commissioner Kaney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification question. So are you feeling the best way would be that the dealers have the ability to do the tagging, or selected trappers and some type of protocol that they'd be, you know, run through? And
we would like to see all dealers. Now, there's not that many dealers in the state currently. But dealers, and then there's also there's fur buyers, and there's also agents for international auction houses in the state. They both have fur dealers licenses, and trappers take their pelts to them to either sell them or to ship them. And you know, it would be real handy for the trappers to just have them tag, you know, at that point where it goes out of their hands. So that's where we'd like to see it done. But obviously, the department might want to, you know, have some training or, you know, to get the information that they want correctly. So, you know, we would like to, it worded so designated personnel by the department, not just anybody.
Thank you. If you could go sit back in the audience, please. Mark Smith, come forward. Okay, Mr. Barnes.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Game Commission. My name is Bruce Barnes. I live in Vancouver, Washington. Here to talk about hoof rot again today. I don't know where to start, actually. After attending the last hoof rot meeting in Longview, some extremely alarming things came up there. Number one, your veterinarian Christine Mansfield made a statement there. First of all, you've made statements in the newspaper saying that these elk are safe to consume. But in her opinion, it was only her opinion, and she assumed they were safe to eat. Now, after going to the tag committee meeting in Vancouver, And the department thinking this is treponema, none of the scientists there that I feel were probably all intelligent couldn't decide if this was treponema, because it's a secondary disease. And so my question today is, why are we continuing again? I'm going to ask the same question again. I'm going to petition this commission. Number one, why are we hunting in the affected areas of this hoof rot if we really don't know what this disease is? That's first and foremost, the health and safety of our hunters consuming these wild animals. The second thing is, we haven't tested for any toxins in this game meat when we know that they're spraying toxins on these clear cuts and these animals are consuming these toxins. The third thing, why would the commission bring in a gal that was a consultant for a chemical company called Exponent Engineering to say to everybody that these chemicals are not harmful to mammals, which is all of us in the wildlife that lives in the woods? I just really think that we're going in the wrong direction here. I understand that the Fish and Wildlife is been stumped on this situation, but I think a legal standpoint here, you guys are really looking for a huge lawsuit. And especially when this could be leptospirosis. And the leptospirosis really fits this better than the treponema, because it causes a inflammation of the joint. And any of us that have seen these animals in the wild realize that these elk aren't limping just because the hooves are deformed. They're limping way before that. The hooves deform because they're not walking on the foot. They start to grow because nothing's wearing them down. And Mr. Commissioner Schmidt here, you say that we've got a great salmon run, right? But the article that I turned in here talks about toxins in our fish, right? We also have Vietnam veterans here that I turned in some other literature. These toxins are in the woods here, and we've got Mr. Stroh here, the other commissioner, it sits on the Forest Practice Board, that had never brought any of these toxins to their attention until we'd gone up to the Forest Practice Board and petitioned for what's going on here in our state. I'm concerned, and I, you know what I'm really concerned about is the image of the Fish and Wildlife. And if I may finish, I've talked to Nate Pamplin about taking him on a field trip, and I'm hoping we're going to be able to do this in September. But with all the gates that are locked and us not buying a $150 tag to get onto a lot of these concerning properties, I don't even know if we're going to be able to do that, because I want to show him through our eyes what we're talking about. Get your people and try and energize them with the citizens here to partner with them to try and fix this problem, because it's a multifaceted problem here. It's not only the elk that are sick, but it's the timber owners that are ruining the wildlife habitat. So, again, I would urge you not to hunt in these areas, because I think you guys are really looking for a major problem if there's something like leptospirosis and people start getting sick from these animals. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Leo Oates, would you come forward, please?
I don't have any comments.
Okay. Edward Barnes. Okay, there you are. Okay, Mr. Smith, you can go ahead.
Madam Chairman, Commission, thank you very much for the opportunity today to speak. My name is Mark Smith. I live in Tootle, Washington. I'm also a member of the Citizens Advisory for Hoof Rot Committee. What I have today is a letter I'd like to read for the record, is that I'm here today to petition you to ask for live testing on elk with hoof disease. I would like to petition Washington Department of Fish and Game to direct the Department of Fish and Wildlife to start immediate testing and treatment of live elk in Southwest Washington on any and all elements suspected or related to hoof disease. I make my request based on the latest Department of Fish and Wildlife meeting with the Technical Advisory Committee held in Vancouver, Region 5, where they discovered that their current treponema theory was not fully supported by all members of the TAG committee, as we had been led to believe. The TAG committee also left very good concern that the treponema was a secondary infection and not the primary cause of the disease. Therefore, based on this new information and the lack of the Department of Fish and Wildlife's current study plan being able to identify the host in the last 5 years, we would like to ask that you direct and support the need for live animal testing. Every day we delay allows this disease to spread and continue and infect our herds. This creates an economic, social, and health concern to our communities. We must move in a productive position, proactive, to be able to resolve this problem. I also bring with me today letters from, I believe you've received, from the Wakayakum County Commission based on their concerns of economic problems in our community. It is a very large problem. We haven't been able to identify it with the current study model or plan. And I've been an opponent of, you know, trying to get live animal testing from the beginning. To me, it makes sense. It gives us an opportunity to study these animals from a different perspective. And when we do try to do the treatment and study on these animals, we may discover a lot of things that we are not aware of in the laboratory today. And that's what I was here to ask you for today. And I appreciate the opportunity and your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. J.R. Robertson, please come forward. Mr. Barnes.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Ed Barnes. I live in Vancouver, Washington. I'm a citizen, but I'm also a newly appointed Clark County Commissioner for Clark County, and I will be bringing some of this stuff to the Commission. In your opening input, you say the Commission's direct link between the citizens of Washington, our Department of Transportation, Fish and Wildlife. I have some safety concerns. I looked at your safety manual that you produce, and, you know, you folks limit the hours of hunting between daylight and dark. You also say that before you can hunt in the woods, you have to have an orange vest on in order to be able to do that. You limit the amount of rounds that a person can use in their rifle in order to shoot these animals. You also cannot hunt from the highway. You can't shoot from a moving vehicle or a setting vehicle without violating these rules. You also have to have safety training in order to do that. These spraying that they were doing in these areas that you're allowing the people hunt in, they put these posted tags up there that say that these things are hazardous to the public, and that there should be something in the Fish and Wildlife Manual that says whatever that period of time is that the hunters are not allowed or should not be allowed to hunt in those areas. It should be part of the safety issue that you guys put out to warn the hunters that there are safety problems when they go hunting in these areas where they use the spray. as a veteran and somebody that's been checking into this heavily with the Vietnam veterans, every one of these meetings we've went to, veterans are coming up and telling us about the kids that are being deformed, about heart attacks that they're having. All these reports are coming about the flyers that were flying, the C-124s that were dropping this Agent Orange in the 1970s in Vietnam, how all of them have been contaminated with all these things. There are 453,000 Vietnam veterans, and I don't know if any of you are Vietnam veterans, but they're right, and they're all having some kind of medical problems because of the spray that they've used. There's portions of this spray that they're using in these areas for defoliant is actually causing the same sickness in these animals, and they didn't start using this spray until the late 80s and 90s for defoliant in the woods. And so I'm saying to you folks that there's a serious problem with this, and the Fish and Wildlife has an obligation from a safety standpoint to make sure that when you sell a license to put the people out there, that all these safety rules that you publish in that book, that the same safety should abide by whether you're telling a person to go hunt, that they should not hunt in an area where it's contaminated with this type of product and that, and you should make sure of that in your safety manual. You should warn the people that not to go in an area that has these red posted signs in it, and that whether it doesn't make any difference, whether it's DNR land, whether it's state forest land, whether it's land that's owned by Weyerhaeuser or Longview Fiber, whoever it's owned by, but we have an obligation. You have an obligation, according to your input here, that you are the representatives of the people that hunt and fish in this state, and you should make sure that we comply with that.
Thank you. Commissioner Holtzmiller?
I guess my question to you, you keep saying they are spraying. Who is they? Is it on department grounds or Weyerhaeuser ground or what?
Well, it doesn't make any difference who's spraying. You guys put out hunting license to allow us to hunt on properties that in the state of Washington. They contract these spraying out to these different companies, do spraying.
They? Who is they?
Weyerhaeuser, okay. DNR, all these different companies. Fish and Wildlife don't do it, but you have an obligation by selling your license to the people to tell them to go out and hunt in these areas if it's contaminated with a poison substance that's going to cause the person to get sick or die, or the animals are going to, the meat, which you folks have not checked so far to see where that meat has even been tested. It's the, where the, it hurts people or contaminates or kills them or anything else. I mean, it's sick. What's going on? I listened to your own people down in Vancouver just here recently, and they could not tell whether they had ever tested the meat to see whether it was good to eat or not to eat.
Thank you. Thank you. Message heard. Randy O'Brien. Okay. Mr. Robertson.
My name's J.R. I'm from Vancouver, Washington. I am an elk hunter, and I'm concerned about the meat being consumable. I did attend the hoof disease in Kelso, Longview, and I asked if the meat was safe to eat. The gal said yes. I said, has it been tested? She said, no. So she furthered up by saying, as far as she knows, it's all right to eat it. I would like to know, and I'd like to have live animal testing of the meat for toxins, all toxins. I'd like to know. I mean, I'm going to harvest that animal. I've got to take it home. I've got to cut it up. I've got to feed it to my family. And nobody will tell me. Obviously, we've got sick animals out there. I want it in writing that it's safe to eat. I want somebody to be accountable for what I'm buying from the fish and game, a license to hunt, paying Weyerhaeuser to hunt on their property, and I believe Weyerhaeuser's at fault for spraying the chemicals. All that stuff, I put fertilizer on my lawn at the house. It says keep your pets off of it for a certain amount of time. There's no way that Weyerhaeuser, DNR, anybody can keep those mammals off of that land that they've sprayed with chemicals. And yet, it's happening, and nobody's stopping it. I think the spraying ought to stop.
Thank you. Randy LaDuck. Hey, Mr. O'Brien.
Yes, I'm a commercial smelt fisherman from Lopez Island, and I'm here to address the changes on things. I have been speaking to many biologists for many places, and the Sea Dock Society, the Friends of San Juans, the Northwest Straits people, all of those biologists I spoke to, none of them seemed to be concerned about the overfishing of smelt, harvest of smelt, on the impact on the stocks. They are all for doing more research and getting a more accurate estimate of the stocks. They all feel that the greatest threat, if there is a threat to them, is habitat destruction, spawning habitat destruction. That's, they were all for protecting that. That's the main thing. Mr. Pintella, who testified earlier in his online comments, I mean, this guy is the god of surf smelt. He is the guy. You Google his name with surf smelt, you get page after page of his reports, papers he's written, co-authored from the 70s through 2013, this guy. In his online comments, he lays out the reasons why it would be very difficult at this time to overfish the smelt. He gives a clear, succinct, I mean, if you have any questions about that, it's the guy to ask. He is not a person whose field of interest is a different species of fish that is covering smelt because of budgetary constraints. He is the smelt guy. There's no, at this time, evidence of the decline in the stocks. The harvest rate, commercial harvest rate, has been stable for the last 13 years. And the meeting, the industry meeting in January, Craig Burley suggested he'd like to bring the levels, harvest levels, down to 1970s levels. The 1970s, from the landing report supplied to me by the Department of Fish and Game, was about 79,000 pounds a year. Our catch last year was 79,800 pounds. There's no increase from what we caught last year was the same as what we were doing in the 70s. And as I said, the stocks are, the catch rate is the same. In the regulations on things, the policy, the smelt fish, the forage fish policy, it's also staying in here that if there's stocks to be fished, they should be evenly split or opportunity given to both the commercial and the recreational people. There is a study done by the Department of Fish and Game and other people recently trying to assess the recreational harvest on smelt. And this is an unpublished study. I think it's being peer-reviewed. I got to see it. In that study, they concluded that the recreational harvest has probably been substantially underestimated and is significantly more than the commercial harvest. If you are going to close anything, please make sure that the sports people and the commercial people are treated equally. And I please urge you just not to close it. It's not a conservation issue. It is a political issue with the landowners of North Kamehameha Island, and that's it, and which could be dealt with through regulations dealing with North Kamehameha Island. It's instead of the sledgehammer and the whole state fishery of eliminating it.
Thank you.
I urge you to.
Thank you. Andrew Marks, you'd come forward. Okay, Mr. Ladoc.
Good morning. I'm here to speak on the Mayfield net pen project that we have for rearing Chinook salmon in the net pens. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Randy LeDuc. I live in Centralia, Washington. I'm an avid angler and a member of the CCA. I, along with several of my CCA colleagues, banded together a couple of years ago to discuss what we could do to improve the fall Chinook salmon run on the Cowlitz River. As you know, the production of fall Chinook had fallen from 5 million to a low of 1.5 million. Our idea at the time was to see what we might be able to do to replicate the environment of the fall Chinook coming out of the Tilton River. And there was a strong run of wild fish coming out of that system, and our hatchery survival rate in the Cowlitz is very low. Our idea was to raise fall Chinook in the Mayfield Lake net pens, rear them in the lake, mark a subset of fish, and study the returns to see if they would benefit the rearing the fish in the lake as opposed to the hatchery. If we were successful, we could not only expand the project to more fish on the Cowlitz, but maybe also replicate that experience in other watersheds. We discussed this plan with the department and gained their support, but they told us there was no money and they needed to come up with the funding if we wanted to move forward. With the information in hand, we created a briefing page and pitched our idea to CCA and other local legislative delegation just prior to the 2013 legislative session. Eventually, everyone bought in. With both the financial capital and operating budgets appropriated, the necessary funding, thanks to Senator Braun, Representative Dungey, and others, it was a great bipartisan effort that started at a grassroots level. By July 1, everything was lined up, ready to go. We were assured that several stakeholders' meetings over the summer and fall in the department, there was no problem with them meeting the timeline. The goal was to get the fish into the net pens by April 15th. This would give them 60 days in the lake, depending on their weight, and then get released in the river below the hatchery. Unfortunately, this did not occur. The pens just went into the lake. A couple of weeks, the fish were put into the net pens on June 9th. This means they will be in the lake for only 3 weeks. While I'm not going to get into all the details of why this happened, the bottom line is the department did not seek the necessary permits from Lewis County or DOE to put the pens in the lake and anchor them to the shoreline. As a result, these fish spent an extra 45 days in the hatchery, exposing them to the hatchery conditions we were trying so hard to avoid. The money we and others lobbied for during this very difficult session, where money was hard to come by, did not get used for the intended purpose. That study we had hoped to generate had been compromised, and the money is gone. Sure, there are 2 million fish going into the river to be released, but at this point, that was not what we had intended. And what we wanted just to bring up is that we had worked very hard on our side to get all of this stuff in line, and we were disappointed with the performance.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Message heard. Thanks. Director Anderson, I've heard of this issue. Do you have an explanation for what delayed our work in implementing?
Part of my director's report.
Okay. It'll be part of the director's report. Thank you. Francis Estelila. Okay, Mr. Marks.
Good morning, Director Anderson, Deputy Director Storr, and Commissioners. My name is Andy Marks. I'm Vice President of CCA Washington and National Director of CCA. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today and to express my appreciation for the Commission's good work over the years, including the hatchery and harvest reform policy adopted in 2009, the crab and shrimp policies, which established parity in standing between the commercial and recreational fishing industries. These and other Commission policies recognize the economic and conservation benefits of recreational fishing and are all commendable in actions in the right direction. The Commission has also strived to improve agency transparency, restore meaningful public participation, and promote excellence within the agency. Unfortunately, a number of these policies and goals have not been implemented in concert with what we believe the intentions of the commission was. The public recognizes and appreciates the commission's good work. However, many, if not most, of these same individuals see inconsistencies between the commission's intent and resulting management practices. I believe you're aware of concerns that has been raised by CCA and other organizations. My focus is often on Puget Sound issues, where some of the most stark inconsistencies and frustrations exist. The level of support and confidence among the user group from which the department derives its single largest source of revenue is at a low ebb right now. All too often, citizens who volunteer their time to serve on advisory groups, committees, workshops are dismissed as uneducated and uninformed. Their patronage is taken for granted, and opportunities for improvement are missed. A hallmark of an excellent organization would, by anyone's standard, include a healthy and constructive relationship with the organization's largest customer group. Yet it is precisely that group who have expressed in the strongest possible terms that the relationship between the department and its recreational license buyers is neither healthy nor constructive. That is a cause of great concern, but also represents a great opportunity to fix the problem through substantive changes in communication. Most organizations never get to hear the reason a customer leaves. The customer's simply gone. We have supported budget requests in the legislature. We have supported fee increases and endorsements. We have spent our time and money to participate in advisory groups where our advice has apparently gone unheeded, yet we continue to work within the system. Recreational anglers want nothing more than to be the department's single biggest supporters as we seek to accomplish great things for the resource and for our state. However, we must also recognize that the support and agency revenue created by the recreational angling community can no longer be taken for granted. Although the commission has strived to establish recreational priorities and implement meaningful public participation, broken processes like co-management in Puget Sound and outdated and unsustainable ideas like subsidizing non-tribal commercial fisheries worth less than the cost of managing their fisheries frequently curtail recreational fisheries and the revenue streams they provide. We would be pleased to work cooperatively with you and the department to fully recognize, increase, and prioritize economic conservation and social benefits of recreational fishing. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Smith.
I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Marks. The tone and the presentation was a proactive, positive way to raise issues and concerns, and I appreciate that.
I appreciate you recognizing that. We've tried to be consistent and professional and proactive, and we'll continue to do that. Thank you.
Heath Heikla. Mr. Estolito. Dr. Estolito.
Dr. Estolito, from Aberdeen, Washington, eye surgeon there. Been a participant in the Grays Harbor Advisory for going on 10 years now. So, as Andy said, lots of public participation. We just want to work cooperatively with the agency, and I try to do that locally. I'd like to applaud the direction and the policies handed down by this commission in the past 18 months to advance conservation and the economic value of our fisheries resources, particularly in Grays Harbor. Really, really happy with the recent policy passed, but I too have to echo the concerns about the diligence and the pace at which staff is implementing these policies. In Grays Harbor in particular, since our North of Falcon process here in March and April, in fact, in this very room, we talked a lot about, you know, how we're going to go forward with our seasons. Commercial seasons for both the state and the Quinault tribe are still undecided and largely behind closed doors at this point. And to me, I just kind of find it ironic that staff is so willing to go through every imaginable gyration and convolution to maximize gill netting seasons when the data really shows that the cost of prosecuting, monitoring, and enforcing these fisheries is typically three to four times the ex-vessel value of the catch. Moreover, the push to maximize this netting really defeats the conservation intent of the policy. As an example, I would cite the last rendition of that we discussed as a group, still not public, late coho netting targeting hatchery coho with gill nets. The gill nets are going to encounter wild coho at nearly the same rate, a pretty significant catch of wild coho, and yet the department would say it's okay to keep these fish because we still fall under a 5% cap. This is a wild coho run that hasn't met escapement for 20 years. The entire 2014 run size forecast coming into the basin does not even meet escapement goal, and yet we're going to propose keeping these fish with gill nets. The recreational community is not going to keep any wild coho for the whole season. I'll skip to another subject, which is our co-management. It's not very functional. The Quinaults just don't recognize the same conservation objectives as you folks do. They don't recognize that there's any conservation concerns for salmon at all. They want to use aggregate goals to mask the chronic escapement shortfalls in key tributaries throughout the system. I will cite Chehalis Fall Chinook. We only meet escapement about one out of five times. And again, Hump Tulip's late coho, we've never met the wild escapement goal in 20 years. They don't recognize that there's a conservation concern. We're going to forego, you know, we're trying to ratchet down our exploitation rate on these stocks, trying to treat the sub-basins separately, and yet they're going to go and just net right behind us and take the fish as foregone opportunity. I think that just really needs to be addressed.
Thank you. David Jennings. Please come forward, Mr. Heikla.
All right. Well, thank you. I am not a doctor, I'm not a smell god, and I'm not a former commissioner, but I'm glad to be here this morning. Thank you, commissioners, Director Anderson. You guys have tough jobs. You spend a lot of time on this. I get it. For most of you, it's not your job, and for the ones who it is, it's I sometimes wonder why it is your job. So thank you for the opportunity to be here. I mean, I think that this is a good weekend to be here. You guys are looking forward to kind of setting some prioritization, planning, so forth, at tomorrow's session. So kind of wanted to come this morning and echo some of the comments. I won't repeat them. I think, starting out at Commissioner Schmitten's comments this morning, I think were very appropriate, which is there's some positive things going on. Last time I spoke with you, I did get out with my six-year-old daughter. We got our limit of razor clams, which got her up at 4:30 in the morning and left, so that was fun. So there's some great things. I think, Commissioner Schmitten, your comments about the Wenatchee River are right on, and as I get into my comments, which are primarily focused on funding, budgets, I mean, they're perfect examples of where the recreational community has stepped forward and has seen increased opportunity. And I guess what we'd like to do is try to find more opportunities to do that. Kind of going back in my head through the list, 2011, the recreational community supported an $18 million license fee increase in total in the 2011 session. Of course, there's the Columbia River endorsement, about $1.8 to $2 million a year. Of course, there was the $66 million in capital budget funding that we've worked very, very hard to secure. And then we've stepped up not necessarily when it was just tied to opportunity, but about doing the right thing, whether it was removing derelict crab pots with a dollar assessment. The only money, by the way, that any user group generates for derelict fishing gear comes through that fund. So we're more than willing to step up to help pay for opportunity. I think you've heard some of the concerns about areas where we're constraining opportunity, and I guess my message would be heard this morning, I guess the Supreme Court is about ready to call the legislature in and give them more than a wrist slap, that may lead to further budget constraints on this department, on all of government. And my experience is that the recreational community seems to be one of the few sources this department has to go for money. We welcome that discussion, but really would like to talk about how we do the kinds of things that Commissioner Schmitten just mentioned if we're going to ask for more, try to look for increased opportunity, because I'd say the support is not there right now unless there's some real things sold in that regard for increased opportunity. So thank you for your efforts, and look forward. I'll be here tomorrow morning to see that too. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jennings? Oh, Tom Bugert, would you please come forward? Okay, Mr. Jennings.
Madam Chair, Commissioners, Director Anderson, Deputy Director Storr, thank you for reviewing the surf smelt harvest regulations. The relatively high level of commercial harvest levels over the past several years should not be used as an indication of healthy stock size. You look back over the years in commercial fishing, and it's very clear that you don't use commercial harvest as an indication of stock health they target. Other indices we have indicate a serious problem. A particular concern is the impact of a diminished forage fish population on our mid-level and apex marine predators, marine seabirds, and marine mammals. These populations need a strong forage fish community, and in Puget Sound, surf smelt are a major member of that forage fish community. As discussed by the staff at the last meeting, forage fish can be visualized as a very narrow wasp waist in the marine feeding ecosystem food web. Surf smelt are a significant member of the very small number of Puget Sound's forage fish species. When we look at Puget Sound, it's undergoing rapid and major biological and chemical perturbations. Off the coast is ground zero for the largest observed ocean acidification associated with our warming climate, severe enough to cause major economic impacts to our commercial shellfish industry and similar impacts on our native species. Going off on a quick tangent, the term keystone species was first used by a famous UW zoologist looking at ochre sea stars on Tatoosh Island. The ochre's presence at the site defined the associated biological community present. When they removed the ochre sea stars, the population changed dramatically. It became a muscle-dominated community. We're facing in Puget Sound and up and down the West Coast what's called the multi-species sea star mass wasting outbreak. we are seeing the widespread disappearance of over 12 different sea star species simultaneously at sites, including the ochre star. The outbreak was first detected a year ago, but is now widespread in the Northeast Pacific, from California to British Columbia. It's been in Puget Sound since last fall, and this winter is detected in South Puget Sound, Hood Canal, and Whidbey Island. We also have growing areas of jellyfish-dominated parts of Puget Sound. These are all indications that Puget Sound is not ecologically stable or healthy. Of the options defined by CR-102, please choose option 3. We need a healthy surf, Puget Sound surf smelt population. However, it seems, based on what we heard, option 3 doesn't go far enough. The existing CR-102 constrains the range of options you have in front of you, similar to the situation we faced with the Wolf Plan. Please initiate another CR-101 to allow the full closing of the recreational harvest. Because what we did hear in the presentation and the review is the department does not have a competent estimate of the magnitude of the recreational harvest. Just have a couple more sentences. The decision to close commercial harvesting is correct. Closing recreational harvesting as well provides the department the time to gain a better understanding of forage fish population status and trends. Please initiate a new CR-101 rulemaking to evaluate closing all recreational harvesting of surf smelt. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Bugard.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Director Anderson, who's just left us. I was about to thank him, too. That's too bad. Happy Friday morning. I'm here on behalf of the Wildlife and Recreation Coalition. As you probably know, we're about 280 members around the state advocating for the Washington Wildlife and Recreation Program. And that's what brings me here this morning. Historically, the Commission has sent a letter of support in for the coalition's WWRP request, and I'm here again to ask and request that you do so. Our board this Tuesday morning made a vote to seek $97 million from the Washington State Legislature in the capital construction budget for the program. We've, in the last couple of bienniums, taken a metrics-based approach to determine that number, trying to figure out what the real need in Washington State is. You can go into more details and questions if you're really interested, but it's basically a real estate prices, construction costs, per capita spending, all those kinds of things. I recognize that we've had some challenges in the past in working together on the program. I really want to commend staff, in particular Director Anderson, for all the work that they've done to really help improve the program over the last couple of years. In particular, the director has really pushed our coalition to adopt stewardship and operations and maintenance as a strategic priority. In partnership, we'll be working on things like payment in lieu of taxes, weeds, operations and maintenance funding, and a notification to elected officials in partnership with the agency, and I look forward to continuing to do so. Real quick overview of the projects that this $97 million request would fund. The agency has submitted $37 million in request for 30 projects. Those are 11 development projects, 13 acquisition projects, and 6 restoration projects, thinning and weed control. Happy to share those projects upon request, but they're pretty cool, and you should take a look. So I'd welcome a dialogue if any of you have any concerns or questions about the $97 million, but would really encourage a letter of support from you to the governor's office. It makes a significant difference in our ability to help provide outdoor recreation access for the community. So thank you so much, and welcome any questions.
Great. Thank you. I don't expect that there will be any objections to a support letter from the Commission. That's a tradition. So we'll circulate something to see if there's any objections to specific language. Okay?
Very much appreciated. Thank you. And if you do have any questions about either that or our stewardship agenda or any suggestions for it, don't hesitate to give me a call or send me an email.
Okay. Now, let me ask about the O&M funding. I'm really happy to hear that our director has been pushing for that. That's in keeping with the conversations we've had. What's the vision here? Where is that money going to come from?
That's a great question. I have to say we're still early in the process. We're looking at a five-year strategic priority, which was just adopted in May. Our preliminary thinking is trying to break it down among three areas of thought. First is making sure that state agencies have the resources they need. And we're looking not just at DFW, but also DNR and state parks. State parks obviously having a significant amount of challenges around the Discover Pass. Secondly, and I think more pertinent to fish and wildlife, ensuring that state agencies and public lands are good neighbors. And I see that as being payment in lieu of taxes, making sure that we have adequate weed control, making sure that our weed boards have the resources that they need, as well as the agency, making sure that we have good fencing to deal with any large wildlife that comes across, and other things like public land ombuds, which is something we've been exploring to make sure that the public has somewhere to turn to if they have concerns about public lands. I know that our commissioners receive a lot of phone calls, and we want to make sure that we have somebody who's independent from the agency who can go out and actually assess and monitor those properties. A third area of thinking, preliminary, is promoting partnerships, making sure that we have volunteers that are able to get out and work on the ground, so it's not just a burden on the agency and the staff, but also that I met with someone just the other day who has hundreds of volunteers looking for more projects to do with the agency, and they'd love to help. So promoting things like that and cutting through any red tape. I think we'll continue to work that out with the staff over the next couple of months, where exactly that goes and the details of it, but welcome any questions.
Commissioner Holtzmiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, this would be an avenue where we can address a lack of PILT payments directed to the counties, because there again, this has become a pretty big issue in my county, and some of the guys have done some really good work on how far behind. Mm-hmm. And the sad part of it is it's a legislative deal, not a department issue, but it's reflected through the department because it's department grounds that the PILT payments are not getting made on. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty major bone of contention the more homework you do on this, because there again depends upon how the taxes are structured. But if these grounds are not getting their payments made, then it goes back to the other taxpayers that are going to have to make up the difference. And it is something that needs to be addressed, because there's discrepancies in the numbers that we come up with and the department comes up with, but no, it's a big deal in a small community.
You're absolutely correct. I think of Okanagan County in particular, which took nearly $500,000 hit in the $500,000, almost $500,000 in PILT cuts from the freeze. It's one of our top legislative priorities. We've been in direct partnership with the Association of Counties. We worked very closely with Senator Linda Evans Parlett out of the Wenatchee area last biennium to run a bill that unfortunately did not pass in the supplemental. We will be reintroducing it, and I know that director and staff have been in conversations about that language and where we go. For us, we see it as this is really one of our obligations. If we are going to, with a straight face, go out and ask to continue to fund the program, it is our responsibility and an imperative to work on payment in lieu of taxes. I really welcome any help and suggestions that you might have to make it successful. But I absolutely understand the impacts both to the taxpayers and to the services that the county is trying to provide.
Thank you. Good job. Nice. Thanks. Presentation. Okay, thank you all very much. You did an excellent job presenting your viewpoints and adhering to our rules. We appreciate that.